Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Giatakis. We're at a small outdoor party at Estrada Courts in East LA. It's a public housing project made up of well-worn two-story barracks-like buildings arranged around common outdoor areas. Those buildings date back to World War II. Estrada Courts is best known to outsiders for their enormous 1970s-era Chicano pride murals on many of those buildings. Now, you know, more than 6,500 low-income families live in L.A. public housing, and about 400 of them are right here at Estrada Courts. And for the past few weeks, many of those residents have been scared. Here, for example, is Consuelo, who didn't want her last name used, speaking to KCRW's Saul Gonzalez.
Para nosotros no está bien.
¿Por qué?
Porque sí, porque imagínese usted cree, dígame, por favor.
Consuelo told Saul that the situation is not good right now for those residents because of what President Donald Trump is trying to put into place. While she has documents, Consuelo says many other immigrants here do not. And she says they are depressed and sad. And Saul joins us right now to talk about it. Hi, Saul.
Hey, Steve.
So what is this all about? What plan change are we talking about?
Well, Steve, it's about a rule change the Trump administration proposed last month, and a big one. It called for making undocumented immigrants and their families ineligible for public housing assistance. That assistance includes both people who actually live in public housing, like Estrada Courts and a lot of others, and those getting subsidies for housing on the private market. Those are called Section 8 vouchers.
All right, well, let me get this straight. Undocumented immigrants are eligible for public housing assistance?
No, they're not. But a lot of families who live in public housing are what's called mixed status. That means some in the family are citizens or legal U.S. residents, while others are not. Often, that's the parents or grandparents of citizen children. Right now, federal housing policy, going back to the early 80s, Steve, has allowed non-citizens to stay in the housing with members of the family who are citizens, with the housing subsidy prorated or reduced. So it does not cover the non-citizen. Let's get that straight. But this new proposal from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, it would kick everyone out of public housing, even if only a single member of the family is undocumented.
What is HUD's justification for doing that, Saul?
Well, one is that it argues it's illegal to provide public housing assistance to the undocumented. Secondly, HUD argues it's trying to create more housing that's available to American citizens so they can move into the housing or into the apartment. HUD Secretary Ben Carson brought up some of these arguments, Steve, in a congressional hearing last month, and then he restated them later on Fox News. Here's Carson.
And what people sometimes don't understand is that we have millions of legal Americans in line waiting for these very scarce resources. Of course we feel sympathy for people. Of course we don't want anybody out on the streets. But the real thing that is hurting people is our failure to address this immigration system, the rules that are drawing people here and keeping them here.
And Steve, I should note that there is a waiting list for public housing assistance in LA, and it's huge. I mean, 14,000 people for Section 8 vouchers, and 50,000 people are waiting for a spot in one of LA's 14 public housing complexes. Mm.
But if undocumented immigrants, Saul, are not eligible for public housing assistance, if they're not taking those slots, then what seems to be the problem here?
Well, critics of HUD say, wait, this does affect American citizens, right? Including 55,000 children who are U.S. citizens or legal residents in that housing now. They could lose their housing because someone else in the apartment is undocumented. I talked about that with Douglas Guthrie. He's the CEO of the Housing Authority of the City of Los Angeles, or HACLA, which runs LA's housing programs using federal funds.
We estimate it to be approximately 11,600 individuals that are members of mixed status households that could be impacted by this ruling.
Any numbers on children who might be U.S. citizens who might be affected by this?
Well, we would estimate close to half of all those that are impacted are children. So out of 11,600, that's well in excess of potentially 5,000 children that could be negatively impacted by this rule if it goes into effect.
And negatively impacted, meaning not being able to take advantage of public housing services?
Yes. I mean, this rule would effectively require those without proper documentation to move out and break up the household. And in effect, and in all likelihood, the entire family would end up moving out. So that's the way we're viewing it, and that includes thousands of children that are eligible to receive services.
So Saul, essentially what he's saying is this could force these mixed status families basically to choose between living together or kicking out the non-citizen family members so that the rest of them have an affordable place to live?
Well stated, yes.
And most people know this, but you have to be pretty low income, right, to live in public housing in the first place.
Right.
So when you talk about 11,000 people losing their housing, those are 11,000 people who need heavily subsidized shelter at a time when we have a problem with homelessness and other housing issues in the greater Los Angeles area.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for instance, we're talking about a family of four in L.A. making $31,000 a year, or just 30% of the median income in the county.
So HUD says this is all about making room for U.S. citizens, for Americans in public housing. What do people at Estrada Courts think?
Well, they're having none of it, Steve. Well, here's Samantha, who grew up in Estrada Courts and didn't want her last name used. That came up with a lot of people, by the way. She blames President Trump.
That's completely unfair, in my opinion, because if he put himself in those shoes and he needed public housing, I'm pretty sure he would want it. And I feel like what he's doing is really wrong.
Do you think it could affect a lot of people living here?
Yes, it would affect the majority of the people living here.
And here's Juana Martinez. Steve, she's a leader of a residence group at Estrada Courts.
We don't agree with this proposal because they're mixed status families that include a lot of kids. So if they remove families, a lot of kids are going to suffer who are Americans. And you're also going to have more people living on the streets.
What about Doug Guthrie, Saul, the head of the Housing Authority, as you mentioned? What does he think about all this?
Well, he really echoes a lot of other people who manage public housing across the United States. He says, practically speaking, there's no good reason to do this rule change. Again, he reminds us that non-citizens who live in public housing don't get the actual subsidies. He also says forcing thousands of people out of public housing or off Section 8 assistance could make our region's already terrible homeless situation, which we always report on, right, make it that much worse.
I really do think that this is cold-hearted. It's not necessary. This has been a practice that's been in place for 25 years, and there's no reason to be doing this other than it being ideological and coming out of the White House, but it truly hurts a lot of people, people that have been following the rules. Nobody here has done anything wrong. Nobody here is receiving a subsidy. So this is just very mean-spirited.
Wow, he's putting it bluntly there, isn't he?
All right.
And Saul, what happens next?
Well, on the local front, the Housing Authority is holding meetings with public housing residents to explain the issue and try to calm people's nerves that no change is imminent. Back at HUD HQ, it's taking public comments about this rule change until July 9th. I should say, Steve, that HUD's own internal analysis says kicking mixed status families out of public housing projects and programs could actually cost HUD more than $200 million. That's because of that prorated issue I mentioned earlier. Subsidies only go to citizens. By the way, I have asked HUD for a response to all of these issues, and as of this very moment, I haven't heard anything back.
All right, we're still waiting. KCRW's Saul Gonzalez. Saul, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Just ahead, another banner name for a formerly banner team. The Lakers are looking to go purple and bold. But will it work? That's next on Greater LA.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Well, the headline goes something like this. The Lakers acquire a basketball superstar to try to turn their fortunes around. And if you think you've heard that story before, well, it's because you have. Last time, a couple of years ago, it was LeBron James. and the fortunes didn't change. This time, it's Anthony Davis, and hope springs eternal. The New Orleans Pelicans agreed to trade Davis for Lonzo Ball, Brandon Ingram, and Josh Hart, and several draft picks to New Orleans, and oddsmakers seem to like the prospects of a Laker comeback. Arash Markazi is a sports columnist at the LA Times, and he's here to talk about it. Hey, Arash.
Hello.
So break down this trade for us. I mean, it sounds like the Lakers gave up a lot. Is Anthony Davis worth it?
I believe so. I mean, in Davis, you're getting one of the top five players, I believe, in the league. He's a transcendent superstar. And not just that, you're getting him at the prime of his career. And maybe he's not even there at the prime. He just turned 26. He is in the conversation for being the best player in the league. And again, he hasn't reached his potential yet. So the Lakers needed to make a move like this. As you touched on, they got LeBron James last season, but he didn't have a lot of help. In Davis, you've paired two of the top five players, and historically speaking, when you look at Magic Johnson and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Kobe Bryant and Shaquille O'Neal, generally that means success here.
So break it down. I mean, for those of us who know nothing about Anthony Davis, I mean, who is he? I know he's 26 years old, so he's a young guy. Why is he so sought after?
He is one of the more talented big men offensively and defensively that this game has seen in quite some time. I mean, just to give you a perspective, I mean, he will oftentimes put a statistic line of 40 points, 20 rebounds, 5 blocks. I mean, these are Wilt Chamberlain, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Shaquille O'Neal type numbers. So those kind of players you don't get every day. Now, the Lakers historically have been able to acquire them. But these are, again, when I say transcendent stars, they didn't just get a good player. They got a player at 26 who, if he continues doing what he has done, we'll be talking about as one of the greatest players to play this game.
If you're New Orleans, why do you give that up?
So Anthony Davis said, I am going into the last year of my contract, and I just wanted you to know that I am not going to come back. So he gave them a heads up. Listen, I mean, you can decide to not trade me, but you could lose me and not get a single thing in return. He did put it out there that he would like to play for the Lakers. And so what the Lakers did was say, listen, we're not going to wait. LeBron James is at the end of his career. We signed him to a 4-year contract. We wasted the first year that we had him. We're not going to waste the second year waiting for Davis. Let's make a move right now and trade for him. So the reason New Orleans traded him is they knew that they were going to lose him. And the haul they got in return is pretty tremendous, because generally speaking, when a player says, I'm not going to come back, they've put them in a really tough position to not get good value. That was not the case here. They got three young, talented players from the Lakers and three future first-round draft picks.
I want to talk, Arash, because, you know, for years now, there's been this slump in Laker Nation, and you know, a lot of people have been really depressed. The Lakers were the perennial championship team. You know, everybody came to the show, and then all of a sudden the fortunes fell. Is this the catalyst? Do you think this is the true catalyst for it?
Here's why they had to make this trade. They went through a period of time where this was the destination team. If you were a player, you wanted to play for the Lakers. They went through a period of time, they couldn't get Paul George to even have a meeting with them. LaMarcus Aldridge chose to go to the Spurs. Dwight Howard took less money to go to Houston. For 6 or 7 years, this was not the signature team. So they basically said, we have to go trade for someone. And that's what they did here. And they paired him up with LeBron James. And for the first time in maybe, let's say, 9 years, I mean, this is sort of like the signature team, or at least the championship favorite. So it's been a while. This team has never had a lull like that in their entire history, from, you know, going 1949 to 2013. They missed the playoffs 5 years total. They have not gone to the playoffs 6 consecutive seasons.
You think you can go from worst to first, though, that quickly?
It's going to take time. So I think people who think that they're going to just put this team together and they're going to win a title, I get that's why Vegas put the odds there, because they're going to get a ton of money on that bet. But it will take some time.
Well, talk about the odds, because Vegas is pretty prickly sometimes about who they think is going to propel to the top. How did Vegas come to this conclusion, do you think? Do you think it's just about the cohesion and about this young player who really has a lot in front of him?
So they have to protect themselves against liability. So even before the Davis trade went down, the Lakers were 5-1, which was you know, extremely low for a team that was not that good. But they did that because of the expectation of the trade could happen. Immediately following the trade going down, they've moved to 3-1 favorites. I mean, that is an extremely strong favorite. And they've done that just because a lot of money comes in on the Lakers, much like they come in on Tiger Woods. So the odds are never fully right. But their thinking is, listen, they got LeBron James, they got Anthony Davis, they have the cap room to get one more perhaps star player. They really put themselves in this position, like when LeBron went to the Miami Heat and won a couple of championships, like when LeBron went to Cleveland and won a championship. They think that this team has that kind of potential now.
Would you put your money on it?
I would wait and see how the season plays out because, hey, Steve, as it is, they only have four or five players on the roster. They don't have a full team right now. So
they really don't.
I do want to see what they do with this cap room. I do want to see how this team looks. What people are not talking about, by the way, Kawhi Leonard, who was the best player during this playoffs, he might go to the Clippers. The other team in Los Angeles may be the championship favorite going into next season.
Let's talk about the trade, the logistics of it. When will it get finalized, and how long is the contract for?
So the trade will be finalized in July, and the Lakers are going to try to sign a big name player. I mean, they view this as a destination spot now with LeBron James and Anthony Davis, and they're going to try to now lure one more player here. They don't exactly have a max salary spot, so that player would have to take a slight pay cut to come here. But we've seen that before. You could make up a slight pay cut because you're a champion in Los Angeles. So we'll see how that all plays out.
How long's Davis in for, do you think?
Well, I think he's here for the long haul. I don't think they make that trade to lose him. But here's the thing. You are taking a chance here. You are rolling the dice. He can leave next summer. He's just signed for this 1 year. But the Lakers made this trade knowing that this is where he wants to play long term. So, again, you don't give up three young players and three future first round draft picks for a guy to be here for 1 year. They fully expect him to re-sign and be here long term.
All right, Arash Markazi, sports columnist for the LA Times. Arash, thanks.
I appreciate it.
Well, just ahead, enthusiasts and scientists alike head to the rocky Southern California coast to look inside the nooks and the crannies. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. You're back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Well, summer arrives this week and the beach is calling. For many of us, taking a swim and relaxing on that towel is about as adventurous as it gets. But Leela Higgins heads up community science for LA's Natural History Museum, and she goes to the beach with an agenda, and she joins us right now to talk about it. Hi, Leela.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. I want to know more about tide pools because we you know, this is one of those things where you go to the beach and you just lay there, right? And you're not really paying attention to the things that are going on around you, like the environment around you. But tide pools are like when you see those rocks near the coast, there are things going on in there.
So many things. And a lot of times they're underwater, so they're very invisible.
Yeah.
But then once in a while, you can be just magically lucky and show up at the beach at low tide.
Yeah.
You can go down, walk on those rocks. They're very, very slippery, so be prepared.
Where exactly are you looking for these tide pools?
So the great thing is we have this thing called the internet, and so you can just go, what are the top 10 best tide pool locations in Los Angeles County?
Wait, that's on Google?
That's on Google, literally.
I want to type that in, actually. So what would you find when you type that in?
So a number of tide pools would come up. Point Furman, which is the tide pools that I was just at.
And where is that?
Down in San Pedro.
Okay.
Abalone Cove, the Malibu Lagoon, and lots of stuff on the Palos Verdes Peninsula, all the way down to San Pedro, and then things up in Malibu, Leo Carrillo.
What do you take with you? What kind of instrumentation do you take with you?
So I generally just take my phone.
Really?
Some people are like, oh, you're taking your phone to water. I definitely want to document them. So you can get, a lot of times, species identifications.
On the internet?
On the internet, through this amazing app program called iNaturalist.
Really?
Yes, we use it in all of our programs. I literally take my smartphone. Some people take their digital cameras, take pictures of all the plants and animals, any evidence of life that they can find. It could be like a bone that you find down in the tide pool. Ooh. And then you upload it to this free app, and then scientists all over the world can see that photograph.
So let's talk about what kind of things you'll find in a tide pool. What are collected in there?
So when I was down at Point Fermin, we found amazing creatures, lots of sea anemones. That was like the number one thing that we found when we were down there.
Say that again?
Sea anemones.
Sea anemones.
Yeah. They're named after the anemone flowers because they're so brightly colored. There's moon glow anemones. There's green starburst anemones.
Yeah.
And they're like what Nemo lives inside.
Oh.
If you're familiar with Finding Nemo.
Finding Nemo. What do you do with these anemones?
I just take pictures of them and leave them there because they're just going about their life just the way that I'm trying to go about my life. And we generally don't want to disturb these creatures because this is a fragile habitat. Even though it is the intertidal where they're getting pounded by the waves every twice a day, we don't want to have our human impact destroy it because there aren't a huge number here in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want to preserve them as much as we can.
So besides the anemones, what else did you see at Point Fermin?
So we saw amazing sea hares. So there's a black sea hare that's about the size of a cat.
Sea hares.
Yes, they are a marine gastropod. So like a snail or a slug is a terrestrial gastropod.
Cool.
A sea hare is a marine gastropod. There's black ones that are quite large, but again, about the size of a small cat. And then we have the California brown sea hare, which are quite a lot smaller. They just look like these beautiful slugs. And again, we want to be careful if we're interacting with them in the tide pool because they can ink as the defensive mechanism against their predators, which are a lot of times spiny lobsters.
Which is like a cephalopod would do, right? Like an octopus. It would send out ink.
And we did see an octopus as well.
You did?
Yeah.
So you don't touch them. You just want to examine their habitat, examine these collection points, these tide pools. What are we going to get from that?
So when you know where and when something has been found, you can track change over time. So some years we have El Niños and the water temperatures change, and then will the species composition of the tide pool change over time? And so scientists at the museum with me are really starting to document what species are in the Point Fermin tide pools.
That's a very scientific explanation, right? What we're seeing in the tide pools. But there are people who just want to see what's going on in the water.
Absolutely. So the very first time as an adult I went out to the tide pools, my scientist mind was turned off and my childlike joy play mind was on. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I fell in love with nudibranchs at that time, which are these bright, colorful sea slugs that come in all sorts of colors, white, kind of opalescent colors. And It's just so beautiful, and there's so many different colors and so many different textures, and it is completely unlike anything you're going to see on land, and I wasn't that familiar with that habitat, and it just was like, oh. So I can't imagine anyone who's a child or an adult who wants to have a childlike play experience wouldn't enjoy going and seeing these creatures in their habitat.
So we're learning about sea hares and anemones and nudibranchs.
Nudibranchs.
And these are all things that most people don't know exist.
Yeah.
And you can find them in a tide pool.
Yeah, and there's one nudibranch that you can find down here in Southern California called the Spanish shawl, and is like hot pink with orange, like it almost looks like an orange shag rug on top of itself.
One of the things I remember when I went, and this has absolutely nothing to do with the ocean, but I went to the Acropolis in Greece the first time, like many eons ago, and they said, don't take the rocks. And I suspect it's the same that's true at the tide pools.
Yeah. First of all, you have to have permits, scientific collecting permits, to be able to do that. And I love people and kids getting up close and personal experiences with animals, and having pets for some people is a way to connect, but don't take creatures from the tide pools. This is their home. They need to live in that space. It is almost impossible for you to take care of them at home because you don't have a tidal zone and all that salt water. And they're much, much happier in their home environment.
All right, so wake up extra early for low tide and go enjoy the tide pools. Leela Higgins, what a fun interview. Senior Manager for Community Science over at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County. Leela, thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's our program for today. We hope you got immersed and some interesting stuff. Tomorrow, you're going to get slammed with some poetry from South LA and how words can bite through the everyday.
But then we work twice as hard and we are twice as good. But then we're told, no, be humble. And what does be humble look like? Not humility, actually, but just be quiet. And like, don't embarrass anybody. Just keep it down.
Just keep it down. The prose of a poet whose words help people remember. Coming up next on KCRW, Design and Architecture with Frances Anderton. Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Reg Warna, Phil Richards, Christian Bordahl, they're all a big part of putting this show together. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Our podcast is also yours wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Let's do it again tomorrow.